The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We have main engine start. Five, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Sunday afternoon California time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Beautiful day in the Bay Area, and lots to talk about today, so I'm going to rush through the announcements to get going with our guest today, Dan Adamo. For those of you interested in calling and speaking with our guest, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we don't use any call screeners. And be patient. I'll answer the phone and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And then also remember that I will hold you over the break if that's relevant, and I answer the phone over the break. And then we have the one toll-free line. So if you're calling and it's busy, it's because someone else is using it. If you think you've waited long enough for it to clear, please send an email to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com and tell me you're waiting for the line to clear, and I'll move our caller along. Our website is thespaceshow.com, and after the Sunday program, we upload a very detailed newsletter to the website. It's in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. It has all of the information about the upcoming programs for the week, guest bios, and it has the future events section for the Space Show for coming weeks. And don't forget that if we have to modify our programming at any time, that modification change goes up on the website newsletter. So check it from time to time to stay current. And if you tune in and you're not hearing the program you think you should be hearing, before you go bonkers and start sending out emails, where's Joe Blow, check the website newsletter. We've probably put a notice on it and told you that the program planned had to be changed, and we'll reschedule the guest either for this date or as soon as possible. Everything we do is archived on our website and our blog, so you can easily download these shows. It takes about 90 seconds, depending on how fast your internet connection is, or you can listen right off of our website or our blog. On the blog, which is thespaceshow.wordpress.com, you can also post comments for other listeners as well as the guest. There's a store near the top of our website, Space Show Gear. Check it, visit it frequently. And then you'll see the Support the Space Show button. So to me, that's the most important button because that's what keeps us alive and going. We are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And it is your support that keeps us on the air. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you who pay California taxes, as we are actually a California public benefit corporation. If you have any questions, visit OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you're free to download these shows and share them in their entirety, or you can share the link. That's a lot easier than sending a 40 or 50 megabyte show out to somebody. As far as the copyright goes, there's a couple of rules here. Number one, don't edit the shows and don't put them up on YouTube or anything else like that. And number two, don't do anything commercial with the shows. And number three, written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. There is a full copyright statement at the bottom of each of our Space Show web pages, as well as on OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. I urge you to read the full copyright disclosure. If you have any questions or request to do something with a show, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com to see if we can comply with your request. And we do enforce our copyright. So, again, if you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. And we podcast through gigadial.net. The RSS URL to subscribe is on our website, both of our newsletters. We're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. And then finally, remember that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit their website, which is www.swfound.org. They also sponsor our webinar series. And our new sponsor, Tom Driggers, who's a broadcast engineer and sort of an emergency all-to guy for technical engineering, broadcasting issues, as well as an incredible website work. And he's been with us since 2013, almost since the beginning of the space show. And he has joined us as a sponsor to the program. And that leads me to today's program. I'm very happy to bring back to the show one of our favorite guests of all times, Dan Adamo. So, Dan, you know, from 1979 to 08, was employed as a contractor at JSC, and he was involved with space mission trajectory simulation, design, and operations. Then, starting around 1990, he supported 60 different space shuttle flights from the Mission Control Flight Dynamics Officer Consult, known as FIDO, FDO. In July of 08, he retired from regular employment at NASA to pursue astrodynamics research consulting tasks full-time. He does an enormous amount of educational and outreach activity, and he does speaking, and he is back with us today. He has written a very thoughtful and provocative set of comments and analysis on the second Mars Affordability and Sustainability Workshop, which we're going to definitely talk about. His paper is up on the blog right now. You can go to it and download the paper, or you can read it online. And it's right there. It's 11 pages. If you can speed read, you can read it while we're doing the show today. And there's much more to talk with Dan about. So welcome back, Dan. How are you?
Great. Great to be on the show again.
Why take on commenting on the second Mars Affordability and Sustainability Workshop? What about that moved you to the point where you wanted to comment like you did?
Well, let me give you a little background. This workshop was held at Caltech in October last year, and as is often the case with these kind of affairs, the invitations were closed to the general public. These were people that were by invitation only attending this workshop. So I didn't even hear about it until the findings were presented in a one-hour presentation to the Future in Space Operations Telecon on the 4th of February this year. I was in attendance of that telecon and all ears about how we can afford Mars and you know, putting people on the surface of Mars, learned at the telecon that with modest increases in the NASA budget, that the attendees at the workshop thought that we could get there in about 20 years from now. So that prompted a whole bunch of questions, some of them very specific, some of them trying in vain, as I have been for the last year, to reconstruct a compelling reason for why the surface of Mars is the horizon destination that NASA is focusing on right now. Of course, there's a bunch of stepping stones that NASA deems necessary before we can go flying off to Mars, and I heartily applaud that kind of strategy. Some of these workshops, other conferences and papers that have been published at a dizzying pace in the last year or so have been advocating Mars or bust, basically. And of course, an extreme example is Mars One, where we don't even want to return the participants. They just go there one way. So I'm very interested in, okay, why do we select Mars as the destination over everything else that might be more accessible, strain on things. And so I asked some questions at the FISO Telecon and also went offline with one of the co-chairs, Harley Thronson, and asked some more questions, and he urged me to review this report, and the presentation gives where the report can be downloaded. So I went off and did that and spent about a month and a half reviewing and writing up my questions and critiques on the report, and mailed those off to not all. I didn't have the email addresses for all the conference chairs or for all the workshop chairs, but for a good half dozen folks, including Harley Thronson, who was one of the co-chairs, and sent that off on the 14th of April, and I've had zero feedback on that. And sent my little report that everyone hopefully has downloaded off to a number of other colleagues, a couple hundred of them, and asked for feedback, and have had a little bit, but nothing really substantive. So I'm asking these questions based on what the report is trying to advocate, because the report doesn't have a lot of depth. There's, as my opening paragraph says, arguable, questionable, and unsupported conclusions, findings, and consensus documented throughout the report. So that's what led to writing this.
Do you, of the feedback you've gotten, is it supportive? Is it indifferent? Is it negative?
I've gotten one really substantive response, and it's from a colleague, I won't name him, but a colleague that advocates what's called low latency telepresence, and let's just coin the acronym LLT for not having to say that tongue twister too many times. He's an LLT advocate, and one of the major themes that I have in my essay is that the Affording Mars 2 workshop did not regard low latency telepresence, LLT, as a viable means of exploring Mars from Mars orbit. And as some of your listeners may know, that's exactly what I am advocating with my co-author Jim Logan in this Aquarius concept that we've visited on the show before. Is that we can do virtually anything that I've seen documented that we want to do on Mars in terms of science. We can do via LLT from Mars orbit, and specifically I advocate doing it from a subsurface rotating habitat on the outer moon Deimos, which is almost in a synchronous orbit, little above synchronous altitude for Mars rotation. You can see almost the entire planet, but any single point that it can see, you can keep it in view for, I think, something like 52 hours if you ignore train masking. You have line of sight communication. So the concept that I like to advocate is that you'd have three equispaced and longitude sites with telerobotics located on them, telerobotic systems located on them. And these could be extremely varied sites. You know, you might pick one on the flank of a volcano, another one at the bottom of a canyon, another one where the likelihood of water is high, or subsurface ice for that matter, and do a whole variety of things. And you could round robin visit these sites for 2 days at a time from Deimos. Get virtually anything that anyone has written down that they'd like to do on Mars done without as much fear of contaminating life forms that may exist on Mars, without as much fear of contaminating your own environment with Mars dust, and with less fear of hazardous terrain, greater ability to range far from the site because you don't have to worry about EVA consumables. You're just using robotics, and you can keep track of those robotic systems from high up at this nearly stationary altitude. I was just, my jaw sort of hung open as I read through this report where the participants that were assigned the science aspects of affording Mars were stating that they didn't feel LLT was a valid mode of exploring because they couldn't see any advantage over what is done today from Earth, where we control rovers from Earth. And it just amazed me that they couldn't see the advantages of being able to almost real-time drive like you were present on Mars, like the Apollo astronauts drove around on the moon. That's the vision I have of LLT from Deimos on the Mars surface. Cruising around pretty much at will, stopping, picking up something that looks interesting. You probably could see that something better with the cameras you would put on a rover than you could through the faceplate of an EVA suit, which is highly restricted in its field and distorts the field of view and all that. It's just, like I say, my jaw dropped open, and I think that's why this one person fed back to me, hooray, I think he said bravo, that I had found this or taken this exception to the report. It's really strange because there's all kinds of speculative technology that the report documents was discussed at the workshop. Nuclear thermal propulsion, all kinds of closed-loop environmental control life support systems, ECLIS. There's just on and on about speculation. Even speculating that humans can survive on Mars for 500 days is a leap of faith at this point. No one knows how humans will adapt to 38% Earth gravity. So there's all kinds of speculation in the report, but LLT was not permitted as a speculative technology. It just seemed like somebody had a hidden agenda there.
Your first note from a listener is Carl in Toledo. I guess that's Ohio.
Okay.
And Carl says, given that you've had hardly any feedback, it's pretty hard to know the why of something. But why do you believe LLT would be dismissed? And what else did you find in the report that was overlooked, dismissed, or glossed over?
Okay. The report documents who attended, and the folks that were in this session two were largely folks at from JPL, and I have this on second hand, so I can't really speak authoritatively because I was not there, I would speculate, and this is, highly speculative, that they felt threatened by LLT because they were among the people driving rovers on Mars with high-latency telepresence. I know there's always resistance to change, but LLT is not exactly unexplored technology. I mean, practice today on Earth, transoceanic surgery, for example, is done, telesurgery. We do limited operations, mining operations that would be hazardous, can be more productive and safer by doing telepresence for mining operations. There's all kinds of activity that you could probably associate with the drone industry that's emerging for unmanned aerial systems that could be deemed telepresence. In fact, you darn well, I think, better have a human in the loop to fly these things because they're constantly getting in accidents and embarrassing situations on the White House lawn. So that would be another form of LLP that's emerging. But it's in common practice on Earth. In fact, we've even done some demos from the International Space Station where a little rover has been controlled from the space station, but it's done line of sight, probably for reliability purposes, not relayed through a TDRS satellite or something like that, a communication satellite. It's done line of sight, so at the altitude of ISS, you get at most 10 minutes of line of sight communication. That's why I advocate Deimos over Phobos as a LLT platform, because Phobos is so close to Mars, you can only see a line of sight over an equatorial belt. Can't see anywhere near a hemisphere at any time. Plus, you are coming and going almost like a low Earth orbit satellite with Phobos. From the ground, Phobos rises in the west and sets in the east because it's so low and fast. And I think you get maybe an hour or so or something. I haven't actually worked it out for Phobos. But Deimos is it's over two Earth days, probably over two Mars days, that you get communications continuously. So I'm sort of having to speculate as to why LLT was not assessed thoroughly in this workshop. They did, at several points, promise to carry LLT study advocacy forward, and they do sort of a mixed bag of doing that at the proper point where, you know, they make recommendations for future workshops and for future study. And sometimes you'll see LLT appear in those lists, and sometimes you won't in the report. So it's sort of a mixed bag. And then other things that they avoid, I would lump into the what I call human factors bag. They largely ignore any concerns with radiation exposure to the humans. And then they also largely ignore any architecture or countermeasures or studies about Mars gravity. In other words, studying human adaptability to 38% Mars Earth gravity on the surface of Mars, and studying countermeasures. None of that is mentioned in the report, and neither is there any mention of what I call hypergravity. When you return to Earth, as almost all the architectures that this workshop embraced advocate directly. So you enter the Earth's atmosphere after being an interplanetary cruise for, let's say, 8 months with conventional propulsion. You enter the atmosphere probably going at about 12 kilometers per second, maybe more, when recent test of the Orion, uncrewed test of the Orion was made, it returned at barely over 10 kilometers per second. And at one point, and I'm trying to verify this, but according to the real-time coverage of the NASA Public Affairs commentator, at one point during that entry, acceleration reached 8 Gs. So you're probably going to experience more than 8 Gs coming back from Mars, and you're going to have spent 8 months or more in a weightless state. And I just think we need to get a better handle on that, or we could have a successful mission end in tragedy because the crew gets crushed and suffers cardiac arrest, for all we know. I don't want to sound alarmist, but at the same time, I've grown up in a culture at Mission Control that says, you prove it's safe to fly, and when you fail to do that, you're leaving yourself open, and that's when we killed crews, was when people were being challenged to prove it's not safe, and that's not what should be incumbent on responsible human spaceflight operations is you prove it's safe to fly, not proving that it's not safe to fly and then flying outside the envelope because it's too cold or failing to check apparent damage to the vehicle's integrity. That's how you kill people. So I don't want to sound like we shouldn't go to Mars, although I'm still fishing for that compelling rationale that justifies the risk and possibly people getting exposed to levels of radiation that'll shorten their lifetime. If that's the right game to play, then we need to play it with our eyes wide open about what the gain is. Where's the unobtainium? Where's the stuff on Mars that humans have to be there up close to see? It's not even good enough to be a demon. You have to be down on the surface. What is it? And, you know, about the best answer I've had from anyone is, well, we need to beat the Chinese there. And it's like, this: if you want sustainability, which was the other theme of this workshop, affordability and sustainability, if you want sustainability, you're just going to have Apollo 2.0 if you get into a race with the Chinese, which you could lose. And then even if you win that race, you could wind up going there once, and then everybody says, ho-hum, because there's no compelling rationale for being there. So you won the race, but, you know, it's like winning the battle and losing the war, because in the long time scale, you can't justify going there. You can't justify the risk or the expense.
So let me take you a little bit away from the report, and I've got several emails that are piling up here, but I'm going to use my prerogative as a host to delay them for a minute. There seems to be two compelling reasons about Mars that drive most people that I hear from, okay? And I need to qualify that because I don't hear from everybody. And, you know, my sample size is probably relatively small compared to the entire possible arena of space people and employees and politicians and everybody who has a hand in space. So one school of thought is that what we should be doing is space settlement throughout the cosmos. And our starting point, and there's contention here, would either be the moon or Mars. And the people that are advocating Martian settlement, they do so because it's the most likely place to do settlement from their perspective, given all of what we know about other bodies and planets and different things. So Mars seems to fit the bill. Plus, it's in the culture, it's in the literature. It seems to be a centuries-old type of motivating spiritual quest to you know, go to Mars. And when one asked them, well, what about if we start out with Phobos or Deimos? They say, and many guests say this on the space show too, you've probably heard them, they say, look, if you're going to go to Mars, you go to Mars. You don't go to Phobos or Deimos. You know, if you want to go to Phobos and Deimos, that's what you want to do. But if we're talking about going to Mars, then you go to Mars. And this other group is space settlement without really identifying where you're going to go for space settlement, other than, you know, we have to get civilization, humanity off Earth. We have to be a multi-Earth, multi-planet species for all sorts of reasons, given the big one's going to whack us out and destroy humanity. We might destroy ourselves. I mean, you've heard it all. So those are two sort of worlds that, if we use your report for a minute, look at regarding Mars. There's the space settlement group, and then there's a group that needs to or wants to go to Mars because Mars is there, and that's what you explore. That's what you conquer. It's been something the human spirit has wanted to do for centuries. So why not do it? We have the capability in their particular minds to do it, although maybe we don't have the capability to do it today. Are any of these compelling reasons from your perspective. And we now have got a caller on hold that's waiting, plus the emails that are mounting up.
Right.
But so what do you think? Are those compelling reasons? And why do we need a compelling? If somebody wants to go, can't they have their own compelling reason, especially if they can afford to do it themselves, like Elon Musk?
Yeah, and we've talked about this offline a little bit, and I found it fascinating about, you know, if you want to go off and do something risky and crazy, you're pretty much free to do it on Earth. So why not allow people to go one way to Mars and retire there or whatever? And my response to that is, okay, but you better not be looking to me as a taxpayer to fund the rescue. Unless that's a going-in agreement, okay? Right now, I don't hear too much of that. But, that, you know, on Mount Everest, a lot of people recently got rescued. And it's something the Nepalese government, poor and, you know, impoverished as its people may be, that's something that they have apparently signed up for, and that's all well and good. But right now, I didn't even see NASA being able to rescue its own astronauts, let alone anybody that feels like heading off into deep space and gets stranded there. There's no Coast Guard or, you know, helicopter-equipped agency like we have on Earth that can go out there and rescue you. And, you know, the resources just to put people out there are so razor thin. We don't even have two launch pads that can launch space launch systems. So you have to turn the entire pad around to send another vehicle out there to rescue an Orion, let's say, that's stuck out in distant retrograde orbit around the moon.
Yeah, that assumes you have another vehicle even ready to go.
Yeah. And so maybe you can contract Elon to send a Falcon Heavy payload out there, but getting something out to cislunar space and doing a rendezvous with a stranded vehicle, you'll be lucky to send them a care package.
Well, at some point during the show, I'll talk about rescue because, as you know, I actually spent some time and researched what happens and who pays the bill when people need to be rescued and government resources typically rescue them, and they do really stupid things that cause them to need to be rescued. It's a really interesting analysis. So later on in the show, if we have time, I'll spend a couple of minutes and talk about what happens pretty much on an international basis and the attitude of the people being rescued about who pays the bill, because they're entitled. Boy, the comments of the mother of that 16-year-old girl who was out sailing alone, who I sent them to you, if you remember.
Yes.
When now Australia didn't charge her, but it was about a $300,000 plus rescue bill, and she was asked about it and if they would pay the bill, and they said, "Hell no! You know, that's government's job to rescue my daughter." Well, you know, they sent their 16-year-old daughter out to sail around the world alone. That to me is pretty stupid. If you're going to do that, you ought to be prepared to pay the bill to have your kid rescued or take out an insurance policy or something.
But
that wasn't their attitude, huh?
Beyond the cost is the attitude that, well, you know, it's my right to put my life in jeopardy, and there are no victims, it's just me.
Yeah, and you come get me.
The rescuer's life.
Yeah, and therefore you come get me. But the mother's attitude was pretty amazing about it. Anyway, let's see who's calling you, and if we have time, we'll talk about this later in the show.
Okay, and we're also sort of postponing the question about compelling reasons.
Right.
And all that. But I'm happy to talk about.
Let's see who's on the phone. Hi, caller, and thank you for waiting. Who are you? Where are you? Are you still there? Did I lose you? Caller. Okay, I guess they got tired and didn't want to hold. Well, if you want to call back, that's fine. 1-866-687-7223. Doug sent in a note. Why the emphasis on science, i.e. geology, is the main purpose of human spaceflight to Mars? In my mind, if we're sending people to Mars or even to Deimos, the purpose should be to get a habitat established and begin to start harvesting local resources to achieve the goal of sustained human presence. So there's the settlement side of it.
Right. And that's a fair remark. And really speaks to what I was saying. We were just postponing. So let's at least dive into it a little bit. Folks that talk about humans being a multi-planet species, I'd first like to get a little semantics cleared up and suggest that multi-planet species is presumptuous. That presumes that at the bottom of reasonably deep gravity wells, major bodies lie that are easy for humans to settle and colonize. And that's something that the jury's still out on that. All we know about is 1G and near 0G. And therefore, I would submit that a better term than multi-planet species would be space-faring species. In other words, we can get off Earth and go out to, as yet, undetermined destinations where we can colonize and settle. Now, if you assume we have the technology to do that, and I certainly agree that it's something possible this century, then the question is, where's the profit motive? Where's the other things that have caused people to go off to unfamiliar environments in human history and make a go of it? You know, you're looking for game, or maybe you're escaping persecution, or, you know, sooner. But if you're going to establish a viable colony, you sooner or later have got to live off the land to the degree that anything you can't do for yourself, you can pay for other people to bring the goods and services to you. And I don't see that on Mars yet. If somebody does, great, but it's sort of a thing that, you know, if there's this government entity that wants to pay for liquid oxygen that you sucked out of the atmosphere or baked out of the rocks or whatever, that will pay enough to justify your presence there, then you might be able to make a business case for it. But it just seems sort of circular logic. Why does the government want to pay all these bucks for it? And, you know, we don't have, you know, you can always come up with a doomsday scenario, but the fact remains that we don't know of anything that's going to hit us in the next 100 years that could wipe out civilization as we know it. And, you know, we pretty much know of anything that's that big, that's, you know, nearly co-orbital with the Earth. But the only thing we could say that is that big that could end life as we know it on the planet that we can't see coming would be like a comet bombing out of the Oort belt with our number on it. You know, it's so far out in the solar system right now we can't see it, but it's less than 100 years away from hitting the Earth. That's the only scenario you can come up with, and it's a very non-credible scenario. Very hard to use that to justify why you're spending billions on establishing a colony. And remember, for the colony to truly be viable, independent of the Earth, which in this scenario gets totally destroyed, you need tens of thousands of people out there able to randomly reproduce, or you get into a genetic spiral that leads to extinction, or you're going to have to introduce some kind of very controversial, possibly unethical technology that allows you to genetically engineer the diversity you need to survive long term. And that sounds like cloning to me, which a lot of people have problem with. So, you know, we're really over some big barrels here in terms of truly becoming a, what I like to call, space-faring civilization species. Civilization.
You got another, let's see if the caller is with us this time. Hi, caller, are you with us? Who are you? Where are you? Caller, what the hell is wrong? Hello? Caller, are you there? You know, it sounds like the caller's on a weird telephone line because he hasn't hung up because I don't have a dial tone.
Ah.
And I'm hearing harmonics that tell me there's something wrong with the kind of phone that he's using, and we can't somehow reach him. But caller, if you're there, we can't hear you, and you're welcome to call back and try, or maybe you have a different phone that you can try to use. But we're not able to hear a word you're saying if you're trying to talk to us. So sorry about that. I have another email that has come in from Bijan in Sweden. And I have an email from Dr. Juris that I'll read in a minute, too. How large a crew would orbit Mars, and how would they work in shift with teleoperating the robots on Mars' surface? Could it be compared with how military drones are operated by teams of specialists?
Well, that's interesting. I would think you would need at least three people to get maximum use of the concept Jim Logan and I advocate, where you're on Deimos doing LLT with three surface sites that are presumably pretty diverse. And that would entail, three shift, 24/7 kind of operations. If you were really hell-bent to get all you could out of those robotic systems, you would be using them continuously. And then if you could get more than three people, so much the better for time off and all that. I'm sure people are not going to do 24/7, especially when they're away from home for years. Minimum of three, and if you really want 24/7, then you're going to have to start thinking in terms of, 6, 12, something like that. Another very interesting concept that they had in the workshop report was this idea of a continuously occupied outpost, a sustained human presence on Mars, modeled after the Antarctic outpost that we operate with humans, where you spend like half a year or even an entire year down there, and then swap out with a new crew. Well, that's not the way it can work with Mars, thanks to orbit mechanics and all. In other words, let's say you're the off-going crew, and the oncoming crew gets launched to relieve you, you will not be able to have a face-to-face handover because you need to leave before they get there if you want to come back to Earth, on the first opportunity after having arrived at Mars. You cannot have a face-to-face handover. So if you do want a face-to-face handover, then you have to stay on Mars, or stay on Deimos in the vicinity of Mars for an additional 500 days. And so it works out that you'll be away from Earth for 4.8 years if you want to continually occupy this outpost and have people coming and going after face-to-face handovers at the earliest opportunity. So instead of just being a little over 2 years, if you didn't have that constraint that you wanted a face-to-face handover, you're talking about a long-term stay away from Earth.
Of course, if it's a one-way trip like Mars One, then the face-to-face is assured because the new people will come and the other people aren't leaving.
That's right. And
they can visit their graves.
Yep. Well, yeah, if everything works out, you'll have face-to-face handovers every 26 months, basically.
You have a note from Dr. Jurist. Given the high accelerations associated with direct Earth atmospheric reentry when returning from the Mars environment, how would you propose determining whether the prolonged crew exposure to reduced gravity during the mission degrades the crew's acceleration tolerance significantly?
Well, I'm really high on stepping stones. So the initial stepping stone that we have out of low Earth orbit on the way to wherever in interplanetary space, doesn't have to be Mars, is cislunar space in orbit around the Moon. Right now, NASA's sort of concentrating on orbits that are easy to capture into when you have a huge payload like 100 metric ton asteroid or something. But be that as it may, somewhere in lunar orbit, let's say, you could be virtually weightless out there near zero gravity for progressively longer periods of time, and then come back to Earth at approximately 11 kilometers per second, so more than Orion had, very, very nicely intermediate between what Orion had on its test flight last year and what the 12 kilometers per second that you probably would be undergoing coming back from Mars, assuming you would actually try something like that. So there's a really good stepping stone available to us from lunar orbit. And, of course, Apollo did those entries from low lunar orbit at approximately 11 kilometers per second. In fact, that's the current human speed record with respect to the Earth coming back from the moon. But, of course, they weren't weightless for more than most 10 days to maybe 2 weeks, I think. So that would be the starting spot. We know that works. Let's try for a month. And, of course, while you're out there, you can also be exploring how much galactic cosmic radiation are you soaking up and very realistically building up either your tolerance to that and exploring that dimension, which sounds a little unethical, basically human guinea pigs, or building up countermeasures. If you see doses that are unacceptable, that violate standards, then you start adding more shielding to your prototypical habitat out in cislunar space. And you can do all of that without spending on the order of $10 billion or more trying to land on the moon. Anytime you land on a major body like the Moon or Mars, you have to fund a huge development effort for a vehicle that only works in that environment. It's too demanding for, unless we come up with transporter technology or warp drive, it's just too demanding a flight regime every time you try and land on a major body to come up with a generic solution. Using the kind of conventional propulsion we have right now, every solution is a point solution. There's a vehicle to land on the moon that costs $10 billion or so, rough order of magnitude, and there's one to land on Mars that costs $10 billion. And you can't use them anywhere else. Whereas you can use a capability to do interplanetary transport to a variety of destinations. There's 1,400 near-Earth objects that we know of that are easier to get to than Mars. And there's a whole spectrum of accessibility associated with those. Over 1,400 of those. And then those make excellent stepping stones when you're confident that you know what you're doing out in lunar orbit, where you aren't in the geomagnetic field anymore and pretty much have, at 70,000 kilometers altitude, you don't have much shielding from the moon, so you're pretty much in interplanetary space in an orbit like that. So there's all kinds of I think, really good stepping stone technology that can be developed in using prototypes in lunar orbit.
I have another caller. Let's try this one. Hi, caller. Hope that you're there. Who are you? Where are you?
Hi, guys. This is Doug from Southern California.
Okay.
David, how am I sounding?
Marginal.
Okay.
But, go ahead. So before you fail altogether.
Okay. Dan, one thing that I wonder about, affording Mars, and I'm going to say both affording Mars to the surface as well as affording the vicinity of Mars, such as a Deimos mission, such as you guys described. One real sort of obvious sort of starting point is questioning the use of a rarely flown and hence very expensive heavy lift vehicle. Seems like if we could develop architectures that utilize launchers that are basically commercially viable, that is, they're flying for other reasons, for other customers, then the cost of a Mars mission could be, considerably less. Have you looked into whether a Deimos mission could be done using Falcon Heavies?
I haven't looked into it specifically, but I'm sure that it could be done. But it would be much, much more complicated. The less initial mass in low Earth orbit the booster can deliver. You're going to need many more launches, many more rendezvous. If you're not careful about how you stage the assembly of this vehicle, which needs many launches to build and then outfit, you could wind up with throwaway infrastructure along the way, which is even more expensive. If you want something sustainable, you have to come back and start from scratch, basically. The original premise of your question is sort of arguable because, you know, we hear about once or twice a year we're going to launch SLS. And that is basically a budget-driven assumption that, you know, we can't afford to launch any more than that. So if we can't afford that, how can we afford more launches with even greater inefficiency, because you have to do more rendezvous, more assembly in some staging orbit before you depart, and then possibly throw away infrastructure?
Let me take a shot at answering that.
Mm-hmm.
The lowest cost mass to LEO is probably not going to be the SLS. It'll probably be Falcon Heavy.
But Falcon Heavy, neither of these vehicles have flown.
I understand. But Falcon 9 has flown quite a number of flights, and Falcon Heavy is to a large degree three Falcon 9s.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we still absolutely do need to see them fly, but we need to look to the future using probabilistic eyes. In other words, what's probable to happen, rather than only insisting on taking into account those things that have already flown. Otherwise, we can't make plans for the future.
Okay, well, if you want to speculate about Falcon 9 or Falcon Heavy, why not take the other step and speculate on whatever Elon wants to call their super heavy vehicle that is competitive with SLS? And of course, SLS, right now, the first launch is only going to deliver about 70 metric tons to LEO, and only over years will it evolve to the 130 metric tons that I think we're talking about. But when you talk SLS, it's very hard to say just what NASA's going to ultimately be able to deliver. And what we're hearing from Elon very indirectly is that he's effectively reverse engineering the Saturn V. And to me, that would be a much better vehicle to use than the Falcon Heavy for, you know, assembling a Mars vehicle. You need fewer launches. You hopefully can wring lots of performance out of that system, and more than SLS. SLS is a terribly poorly optimized system for launching from anywhere off the Florida coast, or probably the East Coast for that matter, because it's not optimized for range safety like the Saturn V was.
Right. I can't really take the Mars Colonial Transport into account, simply because there's so little public information about it. And when you have that little information, I don't think one can make a probabilistic estimate of its of likelihood that it'll, you know, exist, or exactly what performance. It's really hard to create an architecture on something you just don't know about.
Yeah.
What I would say is that, you know, America has not had a docking failure in over 40 years, if I understand correctly. Ion propulsion is demonstrated. We haven't really had clustered ion propulsion, but I think could reasonably imagine launching using Falcon Heavy approximately 53 metric tons to LEO, and then spiraling that out up to EML2 or some sort of highly Earth elliptical orbit. One can imagine really not requiring too many, and not of crew, obviously, but of cargo and provisions, equipment, things like that. One could imagine relatively few dockings at EML2 before using a chemical burst to send, you know, crew and the whole thing to TMI.
So now you're sort of arguing both ends of the spectrum here, because you want a bunch of launches to make it economically viable, but then you don't want a bunch of rendezvous, and I don't see how you can have it both ways.
Well, because the Falcon Heavy is based on the Falcon 9, and the Falcon 9 has a high flight rate due to commercial customers. So however frequently the Falcon Heavy flies, it's based on a high flight rate that comes from the commercial launches. So that's the advantage of using a commercially viable launcher as opposed to something that only has, you know, a use for NASA, such as the SLS.
Yeah, I'm quite happy to see Elon march along through the Falcon Heavy, and we'll see how it flies and whether it can fly back and achieve economies through that mode of operation. And I really hope he goes further than the Falcon Heavy with something that's on the order of 130 metric tons to low Earth orbit, particularly if he can get into a real orbit as opposed to the ones I see associated with SLS.
I'd like to encourage you guys to maybe, you know, just do some, you know, back of the envelope sort of looking at what could be done in going to Deimos using, you know, more cost-effective approaches. I think that would be a helpful contribution to the discussion.
Cost-effective as opposed to what?
Just presuming maybe that it's going to be based on the SLS and therefore not cost-effective.
Okay, well, the paper that we did, we assumed that we were getting 130 metric tons to LEO per launch. And it would be a very easy computation to take the number of launches we required and multiply them accordingly by the smaller yield per launch. We assembled originally in a highly elliptical orbit with a two-day period and a perigee, I think, 400 kilometers. Oh, no, perigee was between the Van Allen belt, so it was about 10,000 kilometers. You know, that's almost a trivial computation. If someone can tell me realistically what mass Falcon Heavy can deliver to, let's say, a 400-kilometer circular LEO, then it's an easy exercise to say how many launches we'd need to generate the initial mass required for Aquarius to depart for Mars. And it'll just be more launches. But what can I say? I mean, the economics of this is probably one of the most complex word problems imaginable. And I am very much an empiricist when it comes to economics. I've seen too many cost exercises go awry by more than an order of magnitude. I hear you. You have a good point, but things may not work out that way.
All right. Well, I have other questions, but I'll maybe send them by email if it lightens up.
Sure, that's fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Doug.
Now I'm going to do. Let's see. I'm going to do a Marshall question by email, and then we're going to take a break because we're at the top of the hour. So Marshall's the culprit who was calling, and the phone wasn't working. And he blames it on his local cell tower being worked on. So, okay, Marshall, you probably pushed the wrong button. We know that. But here's his question. All current rover operations seem to be controlled by geologists. When will the rovers start exploring sites for colonies? For example, a lava tube explorer. There are several groups that have studied lava tubes and concluded that they would be a good location for a colony. Is anybody designing a lava tube explorer?
Not that I know of. And of course, there's not just the geologists that are motivating opportunity and curiosity are doing on Mars. I think there's also some astrobiologists that are saying what to drill into and what to look at and all that.
Right. It's a broader field than just geologists.
Yeah. But generally, it is driven by geologic forms and, you know, where does this unit interface with that unit and all that. And that's all great because it's all about that follow the water mantra, which the geologists are able to make a real good case for now thanks to these rover operations. But, yeah, it would be interesting to try and find shielded habitats, subsurface habitats that are pretty much there for the taking, that don't require a lot of robotic excavation. Because, see, there's this bootstrapping thing that you can get away with on the moon with robotic excavation. You know, it's almost LLT between the Earth and the moon. So you could imagine that we could build a subsurface habitat on the moon with robotics that are pretty much humans in the loop. You know, might not be quite as efficient as if you were in lunar orbit or something, you know, with a tenth of a second round-trip light time. When you get to Mars, if you want to build that subsurface habitat on Deimos, it's going to really require, you know, before humans arrive, it's really going to require some kind of robotics that are able to function autonomously. Just can't go, you know, digging stuff very efficiently when you have, you know, 10 minutes or 50 minutes round-trip light time. So, yeah, it would be really good if we could look for stuff free of charge, and it may be out there waiting for us. And I'm sure if they run across something like that with the rovers they have, it'll be a great payoff. It's just that I'm afraid that when you select a site based on its water potential and potential for existent or pre-existing life, that lava tubes probably are mutually I don't know, but that may be the problem.
One quick email, because I think you can answer it very quickly, and then we'll take our break. Bijan says, would a Mars cycler be the way to establish a sustainable transport of crew to and from Mars, a reusable vehicle which, thanks to the advent of ion thrusters, can be affordably resupplied and upgraded during decades?
Well, I would love to see a Mars cycler that really works. I know you can get them to work, but you always need some kind of, you know, deep space maneuver. And yeah, you could maybe minimize the impact of those maneuvers with solar electric propulsion. But then the question is, where you get all the xenon or whatever your propellant is? That's not exactly something you're going to find out at Mars very readily. You need, you know, some kind of major body like the Earth and the refineries to purify it. So it's just like, I just haven't gotten a cycler to work very well. And in fact, there's sort of a gray area between the classic cycler and just, why don't you just stop at the destination? You know, just stop. And then wait for the good opportunity that is coming, you know, in a few months. Get started on the homebound link, and you'd have all these, you know, deep space rendezvous with their critical timing. If you miss that rendezvous, you're toast, you're stranded out there with no backup and stuff. It just, I'd rather see us with a what I call a robust, responsible architecture, the one that works on paper and may even work for a while in the real world, but it isn't tolerant of failure. After, I'm still recovering from working on 60 space shuttle missions where I was operating an inherently dangerous vehicle. And you could say, well, all rockets are inherently dangerous, yeah, but there was this phase of flight where it was very unforgiving of any error, and we didn't operate the vehicle accordingly. So this Mars cycler sounds like another space shuttle where, you know, in the case of space shuttle, you were in a debris flow and very intolerant of weather conditions and all that. And with a cycler, you may be very intolerant of any kind of delay in your schedule. And we know those happen a lot, like launch delays. So if you're, you know, on Mars hoping to hitch a ride home to the Earth and the next one isn't for years, if something happens to your launch, and, oh, I can fix it in one day, but now I can't get to the vehicle because the opportunity to rendezvous with it was right at the limit of my capability, and I had to have an optimum time to launch. You know, it's just, I don't know.
Stay a little longer.
Yeah, yeah. Suck it up. And at 38% Earth gravity, I don't know I don't know where that limit is for how much you can take.
Listeners, we're going to take our three-minute pause right now, so we will be back. Don't go anywhere. Dan, hold on. Everybody, again, stay put. Back in three.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody, to part two of the Sunday Space Show program. Our guest today, Dan Adamo. Telephone number for those of you who want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223, and email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Dan, do you have any way to judge or estimate the impact on policy? Something like the second Mars Affordability Sustainability Workshop has, or does it not have any impact on our policy and our direction?
Well, I don't think it does near term have much impact because, as I say, these things are looking out there way beyond where NASA wants to go near term, and certainly the budget has to evolve to some degree. As well. One place I felt the workshop report fell short in terms of influencing policy is they seemed to take as a given that NASA's budget was going to just be flat, so they had to work within that constraint. And I really have a problem with that because arguably the best study on what it takes for us to get into interplanetary space with human beings is the 2009 Augustine Commission. It said, basically, Congress, we need $3 billion more a year from some source in addition to what NASA has right now, unless you want to end ISS early. And, of course, in 2009, ISS hadn't even been fully assembled. And so it seems like what we ought to be advocating isn't something that's faster, better, cheaper, because if you want to go in the 2030s like this workshop did, you got the faster as a constraint, and then you have the cheaper as a constraint too, whether you realize it or not, because you're saying, oh, it's just modest increases to NASA's budget. We can take on interplanetary space travel, which is inherently highly risky compared to what we've done up to this point with the current NASA budget, which is just operate the space station. And assembly complete operations are cheap compared to what we're talking about, however you want to assemble an interplanetary transport headed off for Mars, especially if you want to land on Mars, you're talking huge amounts of mass. So we're really, we have the faster and we have the cheaper. You can't have the better, too. So that was the big lesson learned from the faster, better, cheaper mantra of the 1990s is pick two because you don't get three. This isn't Apollo. We don't have a blank check. So what suffers? Quality every time. And that kills people eventually. You'll build a spacecraft like Orion on the Ares 1 back in the Constellation program where they were trying to save weight to fly on this vehicle that was affordable, quote-unquote, and they wound up with only one IMU, inertial measurement unit, which, you know, you need triple redundant systems like that as a matter of practice or you're going to kill people. Or at least you're going to wind up aborting the mission, which isn't any too good if you're in a, you know, launch window that won't get another for 26 months. So this whole idea that you can have all three just permeates all these get to Mars in 2030 kind of proposals. Is that, oh yeah, we can do it faster, we can do it better, and we can do it cheaper. And it just doesn't work that way.
Another note from Doug. Let's see what he's saying. How would you respond to the suggestion that for the same cost it would take to send humans to either Deimos or to the Martian surface, one could send many, many high-latency rovers to many, many locations far from each other to give the rovers many chances to discover evidence for life in different types of places?
Yeah, that certainly occurred to me when Curiosity was incurring those horrific cost overruns. Was why didn't we just generate a bunch of Spirit and Opportunity knockoffs and send them all over Mars and just do that? Because, you know, they took years to die. It really depends on what you're after. And again, Doug, I'm looking for this unobtainium that requires human presence on Mars, and I can't find it. So I'd say your money's probably better spent until we get the rationale. Your money's probably better spent on the robotics, assuming you have the communications bandwidth to cover all these rovers operating presumably in parallel. That's a trick in itself.
So, listeners, if you have the compelling reason for humans on Mars, give us a call at 866-687-7223 or email Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. So I have an idea of why Mars has been de facto elected as the holy grail of human spaceflight in the universe. I mean, I think it goes back to our history, our culture, our attraction to the red planet, folklore, you know, plus the physical characteristics of the planet, which are very different from other planets in the solar system. But why Mars? Why do we have to go to Mars and settle on it and live on it? And how do you see the why of all of this?
Yeah, even before this workshop and the report, I had been trying to research that. And the interesting thing is the report, when it gets down to why Mars, refers the reader to what I call reference one in my essay, which is a National Research Council Committee on Human Spaceflight document titled Paths to Exploration, Rationales and Approaches for a U.S. Program of Human Space Exploration. And that was published last year.
Right, we did a lot of shows about that.
Pathways, yeah. And when you read through that document, you find that Mars is, quote, Mars is a goal most compatible with the committee's enduring questions. That's their rationale. And they went ahead and actually found these enduring questions. They put them into words. And you can read it in their report. I cited in my essay. And those enduring questions are, one, how far from Earth can humans go? Well, if that's really what you're trying to do, you can get further than Mars. You can get farther away from Earth than Mars without ever descending into a gravity well, and you can go out of the main belt, in fact, the main belt of asteroids beyond Mars orbit for the same kind of propulsion required to land on the surface of Mars and visit large asteroids that are, you know, hundreds of kilometers across kind of stuff. You may even be able to get to Ceres, which is a very interesting destination where there's huge amounts of water, presumably, and so, you know, there's compelling reasons there are reasons just as compelling as Mars to go off into the main belt. And you answer one of these enduring questions that the National Research Council framed, you answer it in a better way because you've got further from Earth. The second enduring question is, what can humans discover and achieve when they get there? And that's the one that I'm at a total loss to answer. I mean, what can we discover and achieve in these remote locations where, in the best case, we've sent some rovers there with high latency control? And so, you know, you wind up celebrating a huge milestone that I think occurred last year or early this year when the Opportunity rover logged a marathon worth of mileage. And that took, you know, it took 10 years, basically. It took a decade to do that. And assuming you weren't underpowered, if you had low-latency telepresence, you could drive that marathon with an electrically-powered vehicle, you know, in a matter of a day or so, I would think, taking your time, assuming there wasn't any hazardous terrain to be negotiated. You just take your time, drive around the obstacles, and put in your marathon. Why Mars, to answer those questions, I don't get it. And I might be able to answer those questions better somewhere else. It's certainly arguable that somewhere else I could answer those questions better. I might be able to find more hospitable places if you're into the colonization thing, assuming you can put tens of thousands of people in any given location. For example, I might pick a location about 50 kilometers above the surface of Venus is more hospitable than Mars. It's got almost the same gravity as Earth, and it's got about one atmosphere of pressure, so you're getting all the radiation shielding that you would at the surface of the Earth. It just, you know, the view might not be as cool, but then again, if you're going to be shielded on Mars, you have to go subsurface and get buried, so the view from there isn't exactly spectacular either. Either way, you're probably going to want to have artificial views piped in over closed circuit TV or whatever. Anytime I start digging for why Mars in particular, I can't come up with anything but about over a century of science fiction fantasy and some poorly informed research at the start of the space age, where, you know, I'm thinking back to my young years in the 1950s when Wernher von Braun wrote Das Mars Project, at least it got translated in English in the 1950s, and we read about sending, you know, dozens of people to Mars in a grand armada of spacecraft with wings and all that kind of thing. But remember, at the time of Wernher von Braun's writing and you know, research, we knew of maybe a handful of near-Earth objects. You know, they're Johnny-come-latelys in terms of our perception of what's out there. And we've explored only two of them with spacecraft up close. And then you could, you know, there's a few comets we've flown by, and now we've actually rendezvoused with one. So those are small bodies, too. But I wouldn't recommend colonizing on a comet. It's just too volatile a landscape.
Let me give you some more emails that are coming in. Doug followed up and said, I think you misunderstood my question. I'm not arguing for humans on Mars versus robotics. Rather, can you explain why we would get more and better science by sending many high-latency rovers to the Martian surface versus a sending of three people to Deimos operating only three Martian rovers at only three locations?
Okay. Well, there you're talking. You're asking high latency versus low latency, and low latency, your productivity just goes through the roof. So I would definitely be able to rationalize the low latency better than high latency, high volume. Three emplacements would keep a crew of three or even a dozen busy 24/7 with control and processing data and planning next moves and all that. So I just think that that's the way to go. And particularly if you want humans involved, that's the way to go. The ability to adapt to changing situations and all that with humans in the loop, low latency mode, will just outstrip the dozens or however many high latency rovers that you want to play with, even though they cover many, many more, let's say, than three locations. Given our current state of ignorance about what's on Mars, imagine trying to get a core sample with a high latency robotic system on the surface. It's just not going to be a very rapid process. Whereas if you were doing drilling with a low latency system, you would be able to react to, you know, the drill binding up or breaking. And, you know, hopefully you were seen to have spare parts or some type of additive manufacturing there so that you can crank out a spare part and replace it. Whereas doing that high latency would require weeks of replanning. You might get the replacement done and get your drill back in operational status in a matter very competitive with what a team of humans on the surface would do. So I guess I'd go with low latency. And of course, specific scenarios may require some further qualification of that, but just in general, I think that's going to be a better bet.
So high latency, you would refer, well, we're talking rovers, not people. Okay, let me give you some breaking news that a listener, Anthony Cook, just sent in. It says the Planetary Society is reporting that their light sail, solar sail, has started deploying, and confirmation will take about 11 hours. So for those of you interested in that, that is going on. Michael Listener sent in a note. It would seem that in order to find the compelling reason, you need to do advanced scouting with rovers. Advanced rover exploration may eventually a valid reason or reasons other than the rationale that a manned mission would be bold and inspiring.
Yeah, that I totally agree with that. And papers that I've generated on this kind of discussion, including an op-ed in Space News about a year ago, I make a distinction between what I call exploration and what I call exploration and it's not settlement, it's when you explore, as you are advocating, Michael, you don't really know what's out there. It's undiscovered country, and in exploring it you hope to generate the rationale for the the other word is pioneering. You hope to generate the rationale for pioneering, which is a totally different activity where you are not country anymore. You know pretty much what it has to offer you, and you are going to take advantage of what it has to offer you, put down permanent roots, and pretty much be there to stay and make a living of it. You're going to raise multiple generations there, that's what's required to become a spacefaring species. And right now, we don't know enough. We haven't explored enough. It's like sending settlers out there before Lewis and Clark in the Great American West. We don't know enough to pick the right location. And this isn't just like going off to the New World blind. Pretty much new, you know, as Neil deGrasse Tyson says, you're going to have the same atmosphere there, and you'll find game to eat and that kind of stuff. Well, you don't have those guarantees out there in the solar system. So how can we say Mars is the destination? You know, we don't know that we can long-term survive there at 38% gravity, where our entire genetic history, stretching back perhaps billions of years, has been at 1G. So how are we going to reproduce multiple generations there and establish a viable colony there, pioneering on the surface of Mars, when we don't even really know we can survive there? And a lot of advocates just take that as a matter of faith, tacitly saying that, oh yeah, go ahead and land there, and you can even go one way, and you'll be fine.
So isn't exploring the compelling reason then?
Yeah, well, it's the compelling reason to send robots out there, and maybe even low-latency robots with humans nearby. But remember, it's the change in velocity necessary to land on Mars by rendezvous with Deimos is pretty much double. And it's just this huge additional expense and risk that may even work against your objectives, your exploration objectives, because you go and contaminate the planet so badly when you think you found native life there, you can't really prove it. And that might be one of the most important things we can discover on Mars. So I can't urge a more measured approach than Mars in the 2030s. As I also point out in my essay, designing infrastructure and an architecture to the 2030s missions that we keep seeing proposed could really backfire on a pioneering effort, because those are best cases. And so if you want something that's sustainable, it could break outside of the 2030s. So when you want to go back there in the 2040s, you may find that you need to do a whole huge redesign that you don't have money for. So it just seems really inadvisable to do what so many people are saying, that, you know, set a date, constrain the budget, and then say that we're going to pull this off successfully. Affordability is a very vague term. It's not just money. If I'm an investor and I want to put my money down on something that I consider affordable, I want a reasonable guarantee that it's going to be successful. And one of the measures of success in space exploration with humans is that the people actually survive and come back to the Earth. I mean, even during the space race, when John F. Kennedy says we're going to go to the moon, he also says, and return safely to Earth. And we don't hear an awful lot about that safety kind of stuff these days. It's just, you know, hell-bent for Mars. And not only do we have no real good reason to go. I can't say that people have safety in mind. Very, you know, not certainly uppermost in mind. It's this, you know, this business about, I want to see it in my lifetime. I get a lot of that too, and there's been some good anthropology done regarding the immortality factor in human space exploration. You know, it's a species immortality. We want to be a space-faring species. But there's also this individual mortality that is, people my age are feeling the cold wind of eternity. And they want to see more than just the lunar landings that we saw when we were young, 50 years ago. We want to see us go farther and do more, like the report that was issued on Pathways last year.
You got another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Doug again from Southern California.
Okay.
So, Dan, I'm sort of having a problem, I think, getting my point across by email, so I figured I'd just call in. So imagine as you, in your paper in response to the 40 Mars workshop, you suggested that there could be three rovers on Mars. And just as an example, you said imagine one on Olympus Mons, one in Ballast Marineris, and I think you said one at a location where, like, water had seeped out.
Yeah, I didn't get that specific, but you get the idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, so comparing, let's just for discussion's sake, let's say that Ballast Marineris and Olympus Mons are sort of typical places that we've seen before in that there's no evidence for life. There's evidence for water, perhaps, but not evidence for life, just like nailing it. And so there remains one and only one location that you're looking at where there's water, like water at present. Now compare that shot at low latency exploration of that one site of water compared with literally probably about 100 or thereabouts different locations around Mars that for the same price as sending crew with all of that entails to Deimos to do the low latency exploration at that one location, instead using high latency, yes, it does take longer, but you can still explore that immediate area in many different locations, giving many more opportunities to discover life. Is that clear?
Okay, that's clear. But I think there's a fundamental difference between the way you're regarding high latency and low latency. And that is, if I start out with low latency in a place that is non-productive, particularly with robotics, now humans, it could be difficult until there's a much better transportation infrastructure on the surface of Mars. But with low-latency telerobotics, there's nothing really to prevent you driving away,
but,
and covering
not,
hundreds of kilometers a week. Drive away to where it is interesting.
Okay. Was it Spirit Opportunity that's now stuck? Is which rover is now stuck? Is it Spirit or Opportunity?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Spirit.
Okay. So we know from the example of Spirit that, you can't just drive hundreds of kilometers. It is possible that it gets stuck or worn out, like the wheels get worn out or the motors, et cetera. So what I'm saying is that if you can land rovers, high-latency rovers, in many distant locations where you're really targeting the best locations that the scientists really want to see, I would say it is not likely that one rover or even three rovers could be able to cover that distance and still be, still survive. So for the same price, I think we'd explore many other places of interest.
Okay.
And let me just mention about Bijan wrote in about the Mars Cycler. And he didn't really follow up, but it seems to me as though you brought into question about where would you get the xenon, as though it could only be sourced from, in space. And Bijan said that the cycler would be resupplied. So my thought is, really, the cycler only needs to stay within the path of the cycling orbit. So it's essentially a station keeping procedure. And so it seems to me as though one could supply enough xenon to be able to do that station-keeping maneuver, and you could supply it for many cycles. So I think that could be a possible solution to that challenge.
Well, I want to see. I'd like to see somebody conduct a simulation and show me how it works, because I've yet to see a cycler that I find believable. It either high propulsive demands. And if it does, if that works, then you have the prospect of, oh, I can only use it once a decade. So you have this thing that you stuck up there with all this mass at great expense that you use once every 10 years. Or if you want to use it, every Mars opportunity, it really resonates with the synodic period between Earth and Mars, then you have these huge maneuvers. So, like I say, it's sort of like with the rover thing. Show me how it works. Go do a trade study, because I really think it comes out better for low latency telerobotics. I also think it comes out better if you just stop at the destination instead of trying to set up another cycle in a synodic period of 26 months when neither Mars nor Earth resonate strongly with that synodic period. You have to go through more than a decade before you repeat your phasing condition, thanks to that synodic period not being a nice multiple of one Earth year or one Mars year. So
my understanding is that double synodic cycler is going to have a lower delta V passing Earth, and so that's actually what's recommended.
Well, go for it. Show me something that works.
All right. All right, thanks.
Yep.
Our listeners, our line is 1-866-687-7223. Speaking of Bijan, he sent in a note, why Mars? Because humans can walk on its surface. Not too many places like that around. But why orbit Mars, as you propose? Why not orbit Venus instead? It's easier to reach.
Slightly easier, yeah. And the synodic period shorter. Walking around on Mars is, if you're talking about humans doing this, is not a very compelling reason for the expense and risk. Plus, in any of the spacesuit technology with which I'm familiar, you are going to be able to do that only very infrequently without busting current limits on radiation exposure. Now, you could always modify those limits, but you do so at your own peril, I think, ethically, morally, et cetera. You're going to get, what happens with these things as they play out is you take risks until somebody dies, and then you get called into a congressional hearing, and they ask you, so what was the big payoff that we took this risk? And in both shuttle accidents, NASA was left grasping at straws and really had to retrench to go on. And ultimately, after the second crew loss, they had to shut down the shuttle program because you took too many risks to justify the gain that you were doing. So in walking around on Mars, I need a reason to do it because I'm probably going to die young from radiation exposure.
Another email came in. You're going to love this one, Dan. Are you sitting down?
Yeah.
All right. So sit down. Hold on. Put a stick in your mouth initially, and bite down like they're removing a bullet from you in 1860. Okay. Ted is in Boston. Recently, Bob Zubrin was on the space show, and he made and offered many compelling reasons for going to Mars, especially in his concluding comments when he said NASA needed to get with it and do something really bold and inspiring to show that the United States can still lead and what free men everywhere can accomplish, and free men can accomplish going to Mars. Isn't that a reason enough to go to Mars?
Well, I'm going to bite the bullet here, but I won't get into the politics of that so much as just the risk reward of it. Think back to the geopolitical situation in the 1960s when we took the risk of sending people to the moon to show that free men can do more than men under communism. And, I mean, humans, not men, but back then.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that geopolitical situation just doesn't exist today. I mean, you could say we're in a race with China to Mars, but it's not very existential as far as I can tell. China still has not made it to the moon. They'd like to cooperate with us, is what they say. No evidence to the contrary. I'm tempted to take them at their word, at least for the moment. So it's like all these advocates for Mars exploration have some real abstract rationale for doing it, in my opinion. It's just really abstract. You're probably going to need to do this cooperatively as an international effort. So if you go into that with American exceptionalism worn prominently on your sleeve about how we're going to show you, you're not going to get very far. So I would urge people to dial it back a little bit and really think about what are we trying to do here and why and with whom, and be a little careful about the geopolitical situation justifying taking risks like we did in Apollo. You know, an untold story about when Apollo 17 ended and NASA started thinking, you know, the next thing, which was turned out to be Skylab, and, you know, they had been thinking about it for a few years. Everybody breathed a sigh of relief because Apollo 13 was dodging one too many bullets as it was. Sure, it made for a great human interest story, but that's not the way NASA plans lunar missions. I really think those guys, Gil Ruth and company, were, I have this on good authority, but secondhand, they were happy to call an end to dodging bullets on the way to the moon.
You've got a caller on hold, but...
Okay, go ahead.
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask you a question. So, what is... let's just assume that Zubrin is right, and we can go to Mars. Let's assume it's done by Elon Musk, and somehow he privately funds it. What does that humans on Mars mean? And let's assume that Elon is bringing the crew back, or there'll be a way to bring them back. So it's not a one-way Mars One type of thing. So what is the effect of a private sector commercial company in the United States doing something like putting humans on Mars and bring them back alive, Jack? Is it showing the world what free people can do? Does it advance freedom and humanity over tyranny and all of that? Does it do what Bob Zubrin alludes to that it will do?
If he does it at a profit, then we've got a game changer.
Well, what if he does it and he's happy that he does it, whether he lost money on it or not? Because it's his mission. It's his baby.
I hope he didn't need rescue.
No, he's bringing them back alive.
Yep,
that's the assumption we're making. So does it have the effect to lead the world to speak up for freedom, to do the things that Bob likes to talk about in pure Jeffersonian democracy terms? Because he's done this for years and years. It's not just on the recent show. Does it have that effect? Now, that's not, by the way, why I understand Elon wants to go to Mars. He wants to go to Mars for personal reasons. You know, he's not going for pure Jeffersonian democratic reasons and to show the world what freedom can do. I've never heard him talk like that. But does it have that effect, in your opinion?
I think for some people it will, because that was the going-in premise. But certainly for other countries operating under other political systems, it'll be just a stunt. I mean, once again, if he doesn't turn a profit, what's the point?
Well, he got to go to Mars.
He got to go to Mars, and he tried to tell the tale.
And that's what he wants to do. Yeah.
Of course, he may die young. You know, that'll be another nice footnote to the whole.
Well, he says he doesn't want to die on impact.
So. but you know, if he dies of a cancer death that is horrible, everyone's going to feel really bad about it.
No, they're not.
No, one likes Elon, right?
No, it isn't that. It's just that he knew the risk and he rolled the dice and he's a free guy and he's a free spirit and this is what he wanted to do.
I'm just glad he didn't need rescue, so he didn't put others in jeopardy.
Well, if he needed rescue, I would imagine if he contemplated that, he would make sure there was another Falcon whatever rocket was sitting on a Falcon launch pad someplace with another SpaceX crew ready to go pull his chestnuts out of the fire.
Remember what I said about the Antarctic analog on Mars?
Right.
You don't have that option.
No, of course not, because how many years would he have to wait pending rescue to come pick him up? So, if he's running out of food or if he's, you know, dying from some mysterious illness and come and get me, this is not like going out and getting the cruise ship back to port because they're all
great
puking.
Reality TV. You might turn a profit on that.
Watch Elon Musk perish. I don't think so, but I'm just, even with the launch windows would make it so impractical to go and rescue someone from Mars, you'd have to hold out for the rescue period, for the launch period.
Yep, you would.
Let's see who's on the line. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Greetings, Johnny boy. How are you?
Just fine. Yeah, I've been listening to some of this. And I also read through the paper. I think the main thing, I'm not as impressed by the issue of the idea that there's going to be risk in it, because, I mean, that's been kind of a trademark of the U.S. space program because it was done for prestige reasons, but historically pioneering, whether it was Magellan going around the world or, people climbing a mountain just to climb the mountain and how many people died up there. I mean, I don't think that's the big problem ultimately, but what I do think is we're just really not ready for Mars yet technologically. I mean, we could do it, maybe, and maybe they'd survive or have a shortened lifetime, but I think it's not the logical next thing to do. The thing we really need to do is get back to the Earth-Moon system and really do the kind of things we really know we could do in this system and get a real spacefaring capability going.
I absolutely agree, John. That's the stepping stone approach, and it ought to be, the flexible path ought to be a mantra we're keeping in mind is that we don't know what we're going to find out there. Otherwise, it wouldn't be exploration. So we may need to change the horizon destination.
My thing is that, if we had such a commitment to space exploration economically, that the one-off Mars mission, if you will, could be just something we do in addition to everything else, which we don't have and won't have, then I wouldn't be opposed to somebody trying it. But I think, really, at this point, it's just not what you should do with the limited resources. I mean, I would really like to see some kind of capability to have a sustainable presence on the moon would be much more economically feasible, I think.
Yeah, and you've got the possibility of pre-emplacing the habitat using almost low-latency telepresence. The whole premise of being able to get back to Earth in an emergency is easier. You have launch windows that are pretty much on a daily basis and return windows that are pretty much on a daily basis. It's just an easier problem. But if you want to do this on the moon's surface, like I say, it's going to cost at least $10 billion to come up with the vehicle that gets you down onto the surface and another one or the same one that stages to get you back into orbit again. And it just seems like unless there's something, again, compelling on the lunar surface that requires human presence, we'd be better to just put humans in lunar orbit and study interplanetary environments and how to deal with those with humans.
Mm-hmm. But, well, I think if we don't fly, though, I don't... See, the thing is, to go things like, such as Mars or whatever, I really think we need to have really revolutionary advanced propulsion capabilities, which I don't think you develop in isolation unless you're flying in space anyhow and sort of, you know, seeing the need to do that in some sense. So, in other words, I'm not as much opposed to some of the Zubrin-like thinking or whatever, or even the Musk-type thinking, except I just don't think we're ready for that thinking yet in this case. I think it's just a little too far. It's likely to be a failure, like you're saying, and not produce a lot. And
yeah, like we were saying earlier, we need to explore thoroughly before we can pioneer. And we've got the doggone cart before the horse here with people saying, oh, I know just where I want to pioneer. You go send people to Mars. And it's like, why?
Well, and one thing I think that led the increased focus on Mars recently has been the administration's position that the moon is kind of, we've done the moon, been there, done that, don't need to do it again. So the space advocacy environment therefore says, well, there's no real political support for the moon, really. So Mars becomes the next kind of thing, and maybe asteroid, you know, like the asteroid retrieval mission or something along those lines. But I think that's another reason why Mars has come into such focus. In addition, people are always pushing for it, of course, like for the science fiction, if you will, reason or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I just don't understand it because, to me, it's just as exciting to go off to a near-Earth object. Let's say just 10 million kilometers away. I mean, the Earth and Moon will be a pair of bright stars in the sky. And, you know, you pull up alongside this rock that's, say, a kilometer across and start exploring it using, you know, you're going to be encountering material that's much more primordial than on the Moon, which, of course, is better preserved than the Earth geologically, but still has been bombarded and you know, melted multiple times over and shocked and all that, whereas an asteroid is less likely to have undergone that kind of modification. So the science is there. These are objects that could threaten our existence and could motivate someday being a spacefaring species. So there's the interest in their nature, which we know practically nothing about. Talk about exploring. And you don't need to develop a $10 billion lander launcher. So to me, there's plenty of challenge a lot closer to home for science and for pioneering and all that. You know, there's people that are seriously considering mining these objects as well. So, you know, there might even be a commercial business plan with those kind of objects. And then if you're into, colonizing and truly becoming a spacefaring species, then you have all the shielding mass you want out there with very little delta-V necessary to access. Plus, you can spin your habitat, supposedly subsurface habitat, and actually generate Earth-like gravity, if that's the gravity prescription. Whereas on Mars and other major bodies like the Moon, if those don't work out for human habitability, you're stuck. You can't spin your way out of 1/6 G or 1/3 G.
That's another area we don't have any real knowledge about. Exactly how low a G we can survive long term, and I guess we know that near zero is not good, but we don't know whether the people that advocate it's going to be almost approximately one, or whether we could do something in like 38%. We don't know what that would.
We really could find
do.
Answers to those questions in low Earth orbit. We could even get started on the International Space Station with a short arm centrifuge that humans could occupy for a few hours a day. But there's no plan to do that. Any plan at all. It's like, we're going to go to Mars and just hope people can survive there at 38% Earth gravity for 500 days. It just doesn't wash with my human spaceflight ops experience. just done.
It probably means it won't really happen.
Or
under current budgetary levels.
Yeah. You need the $3 billion a year extra. Because with that, you could then afford to build a low Earth orbit gravity research facility that might be a space station follow-on. There's no need to put it out at lunar distance, although it could, habitat out there could double in that role. But there's no need to go that far afield.
Yeah.
Find out the answers.
Anything else, John?
I think that's about it. My main thing is I still think we need to get going in our own backyard before we really jump off to Mars.
Absolutely agree, and I suspect Bill Gerstenmaier agrees with you, too.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, John. Let's see. Doug gave a question, but I want to comment on what happens with rescue for a few minutes. Doug says his understanding is Elon plans on sending multiple ships with the same launch period. If this were the case, then rescue might be from another ship. So can you visualize that scene in Moonraker with all the shuttles flying up to the space station? if the lead ship or two craps out and has a problem, maybe the ship bringing up the rear can help them. But God help the poor fools on the ship bringing up the rear, because the ones in front of them aren't going to be able to do a U-turn and come back and help them.
Well, and think, too, about, if you're playing that kind of down mode game, think, too, that you're going to have a hugely robust consumables margin, because the vehicle that was designed for, let's say, four people now has to support eight.
That's right.
So, not only is it going to be cozy in there, you could run out of food if you haven't allowed for that possibility.
That's right. And if everyone makes it to Mars and then they find that they need rescue once they're on Mars, then that's where you need to launch other vehicles to come and get them.
Right. And you have to wait 26 months after the original launch to just start them on their way.
So here's what happens on rescue, which I did this really quick and dirty 30 or 45-minute research based on emails with Jim Logan and Dan and John Juris. So if you're a real idiot and a moron and you go places where you're not supposed to go and the signs are posted that say, don't go here, avalanche warning, or don't go here, wolf and rattlesnake warning or whatever, and you go there and you need rescue, if government resources are used to come get you, they typically don't bill you for the rescue. So you can go out and be a weekend sailor, and you don't think the storm is going to hit for 15 hours, and you sail right into it, and you get one distress call off, and the Coast Guard has to come out in the storm and find you and get you before you break up on the rocks and perish forever. They're not going to bill you for the rescue. The same...
David?
Yeah.
Didn't you also discover that can vary from country to country?
Yeah, this is U.S. right now only. So, now, if the ski patrol has to come get you and you're at a private sector commercial ski resort, the ski patrol can bill you for coming to get you. And whether you pay it or you dodge it or whatever you do, that's going to be between you and the entity billing you. If you're skiing on government property or a government resort and the ski patrol is an employee of the government, you're probably not going to get billed for it. As I said, the 16-year-old girl was rescued by the Australian Navy, but resources were used around the world to try to find her, including satellites and all sorts of stuff. And estimates are that over $300,000 was spent in trying to find her, and ultimately the Australian Navy picked her up. And they did not bill the woman, the family, even though there's a lot of question whether a 16-year-old girl should be sailing alone, no matter what kind of sailing experience she has, to go around the world. But the mother, in interviews, absolutely expected and demanded governments to pay for her daughter's rescue and said, not in any way in hell will we pay or reimburse anybody for the rescue. Now, in Europe, it's a little bit different because there you can get billed, and adventurers who go hiking and mountain climbing and doing things will often take out insurance policies for rescue, or they'll have to post a bond depending on where they're going and what they're planning to do, because they could get billed. It's not 100% that a government entity is going to come get you and foot the bill for it. Climbing Mount Everest is a different story. The Nepalese government has very few resources to come and pick you up, but as a result of the recent earthquakes, they did get some high-flying helicopters. The question is, are those resources available, and will they deploy them? Most people who climb Everest take out insurance and have an insurance rescue policy that can pay the Sherpas or somebody privately to try to come pick you up at some place on the mountain or at a base station or something like that. So it's not likely that you're going to get rescued at taxpayer expenses by any government entity on Mount Everest. I mean, it might be possible, but it's not likely, and more than likely you're going to have insurance. And if you have the money to go climb Mount Everest, you probably have the money to take out insurance for it. But here in the U.S., even if you're an idiot and you have caused the problem yourself, the kid wanders off and is lost, and they're searching for him in the wilderness for 2 days, you know, because who knows what. The taxpayers are going to pick up the expense for your rescue. You're flying a private plane, and you fly into bad weather, and you're an idiot. You're likely going to have the government pick up your rescue tab, or finding your remains, if that's the end result of the search. So could you extrapolate that for a spaceflight rescue? Well, let's leave out the logistics of launch windows and having launch on demand, or, you know, being able to get you. Would the U.S. government feel compelled to go rescue U.S. citizens on Mars One, for example? Well, I would imagine that there would be people in Congress and the government who would absolutely advocate doing that. But the problem, as Dan has pointed out and others, that without launch on demand and all sorts of other stuff, being able to effect a timely rescue once the distress call is received would probably be minimal or non-existent. Whether those advocating, look, they're an American citizen, lost in space or on Mars or on the moon, we need to go get them, this is what America does, would be compelling in their arguments to go do this. And assuming the launch facilities and the technology were available to do it, they might very well prevail, but it's uncharted territory, and I would imagine there would be quite some debate about it, and maybe they would go and try the rescue and worry about who pays the cost after the fact, which means the taxpayers would pay the cost, because not very many citizens could pay the cost of sending a rocket and, furnishing it up, getting it on the pad and launching it, even to come get you to go get you off the moon. I don't think many citizens could pay the cost of doing that, even if they went on a private mission to the moon.
And David?
Yeah.
In outcomes like that, both on the Earth and in space, I can take away one little bit of consolation, and that is it was a good training exercise.
I suspect there would be an effort made to have a government rescue of American citizens, and I would expect the same would be from other governments. If there's British citizens on a Mars One mission that need rescue, I don't think Great Britain would turn their backs on them. But the precedents are different in Europe for this than in the United States, where in the United States, if you need government rescue, the government will come get you, and you don't typically get billed for it. So even if it's due to your own stupidity. So I guess buyer beware. It's an uncharted territory in space, but that's typically what happens on these rescues on Earth. And maybe you object to taxpayer money being used to rescue someone who's stupid enough to go skiing in an avalanche zone and then needs rescue. And I have to admit, you know, if you're that stupid, maybe you should get a Darwin Award. But that's not what we have done in the past, and it's probably not what we will do in the future. Let me see if there's any other comments. I don't have any more questions. Listeners, if you do want to get something else in real quick, you need to do it real quickly because we're going to wind up the show. We're past 2 hours. For an 11th hour phone call, it's 1-866-687-7223 and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And guess who has one final comment for us? Can you make a guess, Dan?
Not Bob Zuber.
No. He doesn't listen to the show. No, Doug.
Oh, okay.
Doug is on a roll today. Vehicles in front and back of each other would require minimum propellant. Oh, my God, he's taking all this seriously, and I'm having a great time joking around with it, especially with Moonraker. Would require very minimum propellant to move forward or back along their trajectory to meet up with other nearby vehicles. If you have a crew of 4 per 5 vehicles, that comes to a total of 20. If one craft fails, that crew could be distributed between all the other vehicles. So what are we going to do, an in-space transfer, I guess, right? We're going to do spacewalks?
Yeah, it would really be a lot like the deploy-retrieve rendezvous that we did in the shuttle program where, you know, you never have a large relative rate between the payload and the orbiter, and similarly with this formation flying flotilla. A lot like Wernher von Braun's concept, except hopefully without the wings.
The crew from the disabled vehicle could bring their consumables along with it. Just carry the shopping bag over, you know, as you go through space to the other vehicle.
It's going to be a little crowded.
And would need to carry about 25% more provisions. So that's what many people thought could happen if Columbia had not been allowed to re-enter and instead had kept it in orbit and they had taken up a bare-bone shuttle to do an in-space transfer of the Columbia crew over to the minimally crewed rescue vehicle flying alongside of it. So that's kind of, I think, the picture that Doug is talking about. But again, if you're stuck on Mars and the distress call comes out, I'm not talking about your group on the way to Mars, and you're already on Mars, Mars One is already there, the colony is there, and something happens, and they need to get off quick. They're about to perish, and that distress call comes out, you know, without launch on demand and without a very, very fast way of getting there, they're not going to make it.
Yeah, you need warp drive. And even in Doug's scenario, you're in deep kimche, as my father would say, because, you know, your propellant allocation, again, like the other consumables, needs to be really beefy, has to have huge margin, because now you've essentially doubled your consumables weight for the crew and their mass and all this consumables, food, whatever that they're bringing over, oxygen, whatever that they're bringing over from their disabled vehicle. This is a very poorly told story in the shuttle rescue scenario for Columbia, had it been possible, is that there's all these really big concerns about downweight, and if you have that many people breathing oxygen, for example, the regulators couldn't handle it. So you have to design for that too. You know, everything has to be double what you need. And then, do you even have the propellant margin so that you can accelerate that, you know, extra mass, maybe double your payload mass, to achieve Mars orbit or somehow abort the mission and get back to Earth and save everybody? It's just really bad news if you're taking on that extra burden for a system that probably is designed with very slim margins.
Well, I will agree with Doug where he says it would be sure nice for these types of solutions to be considered from the get-go and to be realistically considered rather than just having fun with it on a Sunday afternoon on a space show program.
And like I say, in trying to rescue an Orion, even at the first stepping stone beyond low Earth orbit out there in cislunar space, NASA has no plan. In fact, they have given away infrastructure to SpaceX that makes the plan even harder to implement.
There's
no rescue. Except self-rescue. You know, Apollo 13 self-rescue will send you happy words and maybe give you some workaround procedures if you run out of lithium hydroxide. But that's about it.
Probably, and I don't think they build or they're planning to build rescue into any of these missions, are they?
No. And another thing to keep in mind is that Orion, in flying that mission out to distant retrograde orbit around the moon, has slimmer consumables and performance margins than Apollo 8 had in going to low lunar orbit. And it has Earth return options that aren't every 2 hours like Apollo 8 had. There was a window to return to Earth every orbit around the moon. Well, this orbit's period is much longer that we're going to send Orion to, and you don't have the optimal departure geometry for sometimes days at a time. So we'll just have to see how that shakes out, hopefully successfully, because you know, all our eggs are in one basket here.
We have another 11th hour call. So, hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you?
Hi, David. It's Mike Listener in New Hampshire.
Welcome, Michael.
Yeah, just on the, I was listening on the topic of rescue, and Chris, when Chris Newman and I wrote our piece on Mars One, one of the things we put forward is one of the things the government's going to have to consider is that if Mars One fails to, you know, live up to what it needs to do, to its responsibilities to keep a colony, if they ever get one there, which I don't think they will, if they fail to live up to their responsibilities, the government is going to have to step in, which is why, you know, and people get mad at me all the time when I say this, which is why I think initially the government would be hesitant to grant a launch license to begin with to any of these adventurers because of the simple fact if they do die en route, there's not going to be any way to rescue them, and the political fallout at home is going to be substantial. I mean, the media, you and I both know a lot about the media, and we know the media would have a field day with it and would be guilt-tripping the government until, you know, for years to come, and it could potentially bring down an administration as well. So from a policy standpoint, for even granting a launch license, I don't think the government would grant a license to these private adventurers just because of the simple fact they could fail and there would be no way for them to be rescued.
Well, but first of all, it is the standard, at least in the United States, that government will go try and pick you up and they don't bill you for the rescue. But if they're already on Mars, given that there aren't launch-on-demand vehicles and you've got launch windows to deal with and then the transit time. I mean, even if you had nuclear rockets, which we clearly don't have, you still need to have a launch-on-demand nuclear rocket. You still, Dan can correct me or not, but you still are going to have launch windows, right, Dan, even with a nuclear rocket?
Yeah, you need warp drive to get around this problem.
You know, the distress call goes out. These people are on Mars. You're not going to get there in time, even if the taxpayers are funding a mission to go and pick them up. There's just no physical way to go do that. When I had Sonia on the interview, who is one of the Mars One 100 finalists, who actually impressed me a lot. She's very bright, very knowledgeable, funny lady. And she was not a dummy about Mars by any means. She was pretty well informed about Mars and the mission. But I asked her near the end of the show if she expected to be rescued, and she said, and I know, Dan, you heard the show too, but I know she said something like that, I would hope they would come and get us, but I don't know. And if they don't, you know, so be it, right? She also said if the government did not allow them to launch, she would acquiesce to that, thinking the government knows better and is watching out for her safety. So those were two things she said along that line. So would they grant a launch license because there's no way to go rescue them? I don't know the answer to that. But she would hope that government someplace would come get her, although she doesn't know how that could happen. And I don't know how that could happen either. Even if you had a rocket on the pad ready to go, they have to put out the rescue call while you're in a launch window to come pick them up, and they have to be able to hold on for what, 8 months?
Yeah, or something like that.
Or I mean, 7 months?
Yeah, it depends on the exact scenario. But you know, another thing to consider besides the press having a field day with the government is what happens after any of these disasters is the whole show shuts down while, you know, the charges are leveled and the guilty parties are identified or the faulty procedures are corrected and, you know, the infrastructure is made more robust. And so it ruins everybody's, ruins everybody's day. Not just
exactly. Well, look what happened. If Apollo 13 hadn't turned out the way it did, that would have been the end of the Apollo program right there.
Yep.
Plain and simple. And people will argue and say, well, maybe not. So I'm telling you, there was enough people in Congress looking for a reason to kill it. That would have given them enough ammunition to pull the funding right there.
Well, the fire didn't kill Apollo. Apollo 1. So I don't know why would that have killed the program.
You lost men on a launch pad on the pad during a test in Apollo 1. The other, Apollo 13, you would have actually lost men in space without every hope of recovering their bodies. And that would have been played up very heavily on the political scene as well, and it would have been something that would have haunted the space program for decades.
Yep, it was a tipping point, but also remember that with Apollo 204, Apollo 1, that we hadn't landed on the moon yet. We had the assassinated president's deadline still to meet.
Yeah, now,
Apollo 13, we'd done it twice.
One other thing about rescue, for those who think, well, you know, maybe another country can do it, the U.S. is a stick in the mud and all that. So, first of all other countries are subject to the same physics constraints that the United States is.
Yep.
Okay, and Europe doesn't really have a launcher to try to do this with other than an Ariane, but they don't have any way to bring a crew back on an Ariane. So let's leave Europe out separate from the United States. So then let's look at Russia. So Russia, would they be able to do this? I mean, technically they might be able to do this if they had a launch-on-demand rocket and they were ready to go and they could actually reach the right destination from their launch center. But what's the likelihood of them having launch-on-demand services and being willing to make the investment for that kind of thing? And then I don't know enough about China's program, but I don't think that they would have the capability to go pull someone out from Mars. I don't know exactly where they launch from and what that would mean from getting to Mars or something like that.
But you know, this is an interesting
it's an international problem, and I think all of the countries that can launch rockets to get to Mars are going to be in the same boat. And I don't, you know, maybe, you know, Great Britain will say, hey, United States, you got to go pick up our citizens on Mars 1, because maybe there's no U.S. citizens on Mars 1. I don't know. But we wouldn't have the capability to do it even if it was our own citizens, more than likely.
You know, getting back to rescue in cislunar space, that's another reason I just can't buy into the class of launch capability represented by Falcon Heavy by the 130 metric ton SLS, is that if you have a rescue scenario developed, ground-up rescue for cislunar space, even down to the lunar surface, presumably, if there's infrastructure. But let's say in cislunar space, you can get there with a single launch with basically a duplicate vehicle, not just a care package, not just some happy words. And see, with Falcon 9 or with Falcon Heavy, you're going to require multiple launches, rendezvous, assembly in low Earth orbit, and then you can depart on the rescue. You need good weather at the launch site, and on and on and on. And meanwhile, the clock's ticking on the crew's consumables out there in cislunar space, presumably, and hopefully they've got margins to meet the delay. But if you have something like 130 metric ton, 150 metric ton, you know, something well over 100 metric tons to initial mass in low Earth orbit, then you can do in a single launch, mount a rescue mission with something like an Orion to bring the crew back.
So guys, let me ask you this, because here's what you're going to hear from a lot of different people. When the explorers left Europe, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Great Britain, and they sailed to open trade routes and do all of that. If their ships got in trouble on the sea, if they had problems, there was no rescue. You know, they Great Britain or Portugal wasn't sending out. Of course, they had no communications.
Yeah.
They probably didn't know they got in trouble.
That's a big difference.
Lewis and Clark.
You don't get to hear the people saying, help, help.
Yeah, Lewis and Clark got in trouble. There, nobody's were, you know, the people going out to explore the poles and all of that, that they're not getting rescued. So people who do these things take these risks on and understand that there basically is no return if they get in trouble. Except we do have communication, so, you know, there'll probably be some farewell messages sent back.
Mm-hmm.
But you will hear that, that, look, you know, if you go, you take the risk that you're not going to be rescued. The problem with that is in the modern Western world, we rescue people. We don't abandon people in need, and we spend the money and worry about who pays the bill after the fact. And if we can come get you, we try our very, very best, and firemen and people, look at, they went up into, you know, the World Trade Center, and how many of them died trying to do that. They run toward trouble and rescue. They don't run away from it, and they don't worry about the cost of doing it. And I don't think space is going to be any different, because this is our modern world that we live in. And if, I mean, if we have the capability, I think they'll try to get a rescue underway. If we don't have the capability, then I don't know. I don't know,
well,
Michael, if you're right or not about launch
license.
If
you don't even have the capability to try a best effort, they will shut you down if you kill people, if you can't rescue people. They will shut you down.
Very likely. And I think that if you truly become a spacefaring nation, if we truly become a spacefaring nation, we have rescue scenarios available, even if they're just on a limited basis, because that's what an advanced civilized nation does. They don't turn their back on people in need.
I mean, I think the bottom line is, like your guest has been saying, we don't have warp drive or impulse drive yet. Now, with those two key pieces of technology, that's a game changer. We don't have to worry about Delta V or, you know, whether or not the planet is on the other side of the sun or whatever, because that type of capability would be able to overcome that obstacle. But I really hate to say this, but everybody's just too fixated. Star Trek, I love Star Trek. I've watched all the series, but people's minds are fixated too much into Star Trek and not really into the realities of what they're even contemplating. I mean, people argue about it ad nauseum in the forums. Well, we can do this, we can do this, we can do this. Now, I listened to Dr. Zubrin, and he's a very zealous person, and I admire that about him, but I think he is really not looking at all the issues that are out there. And the bottom line is, space kills. And and if you get caught up there is not going to be any rescue. I mean, it's going to be the ultimate informed consent. If you go up there and something goes wrong, we're not going to be able to rescue you. You're going to die. And that's just the way it's going to have to be.
Well, and you're right. They may say because of that, and that goes so contrary to the way we run our nation, you don't get a launch license. Sorry, go back to the end of the line and redevelop it with a rescue scenario.
And I think that's the way it's going to happen. You know, Mars One is not going to get off for all the other reasons that are out there. That's probably one of the reasons it won't fly.
And
no pun intended.
Yeah, and so even if there's no U.S. citizens on it, they're going to look to the United States to come rescue them, because we're the ones with the rocket capability to probably do it and with the ethics to probably want to do it. And we have the launch facilities to do it. So I don't know. I think the rescue scenarios, guys, are understated in all this talk about space settlement and all that, because everybody focuses on, okay, you're going to take the risk. But maybe the people are willing to take the risk. Will government let that be sufficient? And I don't know the answer to that. Government may say, we got to come get you. And regardless of whether you volunteered or not. You know, because Zubrin is right. No one's being drafted to go to Mars. Everybody who volunteers, who goes to Mars, is a volunteer. But does that mean that your government's going to turn a back on you if, in fact, you get in trouble? And I don't think they will. That's my personal opinion. But obviously, until this scenario comes up in real life, we won't know, will we? But we rescue.
Guess not.
But we rescue people. So that's why I did the research. We rescue people. We try to get them. We go into harm's way. We go into the storm. We go into the burning building.
But not always.
Well,
not always. I mean, look at Hurricane Sandy. When Chris Christie, love him or hate him, he made it very clear to his residents. If you're still, he made a mandatory evacuation. He says, if you're still there, nobody's going to come and get you if you get in trouble. So there are limits to what the government will do for rescue.
Well, that's right. But as soon as the conditions get such that the rescuers can go in and try to find you and get you, they will come in and try to find you and get you. You know, or even retrieve your body. But, yeah, they'll do their best to keep the rescuer safe, although that wasn't the case with 9/11. They went right into those buildings. Guys, we're at a 2.5 hours. Michael, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, that was an excellent show, David. Your guest brought the other side of the perspective on Mars exploration that always, you give good balance to your shows, and again, excellent programming, and thank you very much.
Okay, and listeners, Michael's on next Sunday, so you'll get an hour and a half or 2 hour dose of him again next week, so get ready for it. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
Okay, listeners, no more calls. I'm not taking any more calls for today, but you got two emails that I'm going to read, and I don't know what they say. So Doug has an email titled, I tried to resist writing anymore, but I just couldn't let it go. That, Doug, is because you're addicted.
It's a compliment.
That's right, and he's addicted to space travel and space flight. I got to put the question marks and the punctuation in here while I talk. We need a 130-10 launcher to rescue in cislunar space. Two question marks, Dan. Saturn V was only about 114 tons, and it sent hardware all the way to the lunar surface and back. We don't need an even larger vehicle just to go to cislunar space. We wouldn't need to assemble a vehicle in LEO to go to cislunar space. We would need to send a capsule and the propulsion module to bring them back.
First of all, on the metrics of initial mass and low Earth orbit, we may not be speaking the same language, but I've actually run the numbers, and I'll be happy to share them with you on what Apollo 17 delivered to low Earth orbit. It was 140 metric tons. And this was a real low Earth orbit, you know, about, I think, just under 185 kilometers or 90 nautical miles circular, whereas SLS talks 130 metric tons into an orbit that has a negative perigee height. So I'm not sure what that means to me, but I've tried making equivalent computations. At any rate, when you're mounting a rescue, you're going to have to be able to throw something out to the moon that can stop there and rendezvous and then bring somebody back. Even if there's nobody aboard the rescue vehicle, it's still, you're talking about some pretty appreciable weight and mass. Yes, Apollo did send enough mass to put a lunar module aboard and land on the moon and that kind of thing. But that's why, even though SLS in its evolved state isn't quite as capable as a Saturn V, the best way I can measure it, which is initial mass to low Earth orbit, just gross initial mass, it still is probably going to be adequate, but barely adequate, to rescue something in a large lunar orbit. Of course, when you talk about large lunar orbits, if the scenario is time critical, there's nothing to say that this orbit, which has a period of 14 days, is going to have the vehicle you're trying to rescue on the right side of it, so that, you know, your propulsive capability with Orion is actually able to pull off the rendezvous before the clock runs out on the crew. So there's all kinds of complications that make me regard the puts and takes on 130 metric tons as sort of fair to say that's about the minimum that would constitute a viable rescue capability, basically, you know, any day launch, that could rescue somebody in the kinds of orbits that Orion will get into. So the Saturn V, believe it or not, and of course NASA keeps saying, SLS in its evolved state is the most powerful, most capable rocket ever built. Of course, it hadn't been built yet, but according to the specs that I can get from them, that is not true. Apollo 17 delivered more to low Earth orbit, a viable low Earth orbit, than the evolved SLS can. So I'm being very kind in saying that this 130 metric ton SLS could be a viable rescue vehicle.
The last question is from John Hunt in Fort Worth. With any near-term technologies, i.e. chemical and nuclear thermal, there is no way to rescue a failing Mars mission, period.
Yeah, and you know, that sort of works in another way when you ask a Mars vehicle that's done trans-Mars injection and is headed out toward Mars to do an abort and come back to Earth. Even with a very robust design that we did for Aquarius, Jim Logan and I found that at best you might have maybe 2 weeks before you reach the point of no return, and your only abort option is to continue on to Mars, where hopefully you've got some kind of infrastructure to support you.
Dan, we got to conclude, so I'll ask you for closing comments, pearls of wisdom. What would you like to offer?
Well, the sponsors of this workshop were the the Explore Mars Incorporated and the American Astronautical Society, and I think they would have been better served if they'd opened participation up a little more, certainly to include participation by human factors folks, specifically folks with experience in aerospace medicine, to breathe a little reality into the situation, and also folks with LLT experience, so that option could be seriously considered in lieu of putting people on the surface of Mars. I hope people enjoy this report. I'm certainly happy to entertain any questions folks have from reading it.
Okay. Thank you for a 2.5 hour space show program. That's a pretty long program for us. And we'll look forward to talking to you again. And listeners, if especially those of you on archives, if you hear the program, go ahead and post your comments for Dan on the blog. I'll make sure that Dan sees everything that is posted or written on the blog, good or bad. And let it roll, so they say. And Dan, thanks for staying with us for so long, and everybody, thanks for participating and for your emails. I really wasn't expecting to see such a huge discussion topic of rescue, but maybe, you know, that's worth a debate on the space show or something like that. If I could figure out who the people are to go do it, that might be one of those secret lurking topics that has a lot of energy behind it. That
I hope so, David, because there's no one at NASA I approached that's thought about it.
you don't think any individual engineers or people have thought about rescue, even privately or personally?
Well, at NASA, certainly not as part of their job. Yeah, it would have to have been some kind of private kind of thing, because there's nothing being done about that. And, you know, like I say, NASA's giving away infrastructure or renting off infrastructure that they would need if they were serious about launch on need kind of capability, like they had for Skylab and like they had for Space Shuttle some of the time.
Listeners, if you would like a space show debate on rescue in space or rescue of Mars missions, and you know some people who you think would be uniquely qualified to participate in such a debate, let me know and I'll see if I can arrange it. I'm actually surprised at the amount of time that we ended up spending on the subject and the amount of interest that was in it. So maybe it is one of those secret lurking topics that you don't get to hear that much about, and there's a lot of energy behind it, so maybe it should be explored in detail. I don't know of any books about it, and I don't know of any papers that have been written about rescue in space. Do you?
Oh, other than historic accounts of Apollo 13, and of course, as I say, that's self-rescue. That's not really what we're talking
about. Right. No, we're talking about a government or a private party coming up and going to get you if you get stranded up there.
All right. It's all science fiction,
far as I can recall.
Listeners, thank you very much for being with us today, and check the newsletters, and we'll be back for a full week of Space Show programming starting tomorrow. Everybody have a great week. Thanks again to Dan, Adamo, and all of you who participated. Goodbye from the Space Show.